Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of the Racket Magazine podcast is brought to you by Sergio Tacchini, offering iconic tracksuits, classic polos, and the new Youngline sneaker. Originally designed in the mid-1980s, it's our favorite spring silhouette, and it's back. You can get it now at sergiotacchini.com and follow them on Instagram at sergiotacchini_official for updates. Enter the promo code RACKETMAG at checkout, and you'll get 30% off your order.
In Wimbledon 2006, we got in a brawl.
Hello, Caitlin.
It's week 9 of quarantine. Luckily, people keep lining up to talk with us. And this week, we have two guests.
We have two guests, and they happen to be very good-looking, and they look the same. They are the Bryan brothers, Mike and Bob, who are quarantining basically three houses from each other in California, which Mike's really happy about because Bob usually is in Florida. But, you know, these guys, I've known them obviously since they came out onto the Pro Tour. I've played world team tennis with them both. I played mixed doubles with Bob Bryan at the US Open. And we lost to Mike Bryan. So they're just great guys. They're great for tennis. They've been great for the game of doubles, which I know you're happy about. Oh, my God. Some of the stories that they tell me, I could have talked to them for hours and hours. And they could have talked for hours, too. It was really fun.
Well, they've had insanely long careers. I remember being at, you know, the Junior Copper Bowl and Fiesta Bowl and seeing them play. They were, I think, only a year older than me. So they've had a 20-plus year career, and they've won so many Grand Slams, it's insane. One thing I was sort of curious to know is that they're still quite physical with each other, so to speak. You want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, there were some really fun, surprising things that they told me in this podcast. One of them about their birth order, which is even funnier. But also, they're still quite physical with each other. They don't, like, just tell each other off. Like, you know, most doubles partners sometimes have a bit of a thing. They are physical. Like, they will punch each other, including a great story at Wimbledon where their poor old coach for a long, long time, David McPherson, or as we call him, Macca, had to get into the, I'm sure had to get in between them so many times, and one time in particular in a transportation car at Wimbledon. It's an awesome story. Oh, there's an even better one at the Australian Open, but you just have to listen to hear it.
Well, these guys are delightful. They're both parents. And as you said, they are not usually in the same space, but because of the quarantine, their families are three houses away. What a good and delightful chat this was. I feel like you guys could have had a part 2 and 3. And because of the length, we're over an hour. So please buckle up and enjoy both of these brothers, their stories. And we'll have to do part 2 and maybe 3 if you have time. And we know you do.
Yeah, we're here for you, people. We're here for you. And this is a long one, but it's a great one because we have two. So enjoy it. I have to start by saying thank you to my amazing friends. The greatest doubles team of all time have joined me this week on the Racket Magazine podcast, Bob and Mike Bryan. And I am looking at them on Zoom right now, and I know that Bob has the hat on and Mike doesn't have a hat on.
Because I don't like my hair game right now. Look at this.
Well, thankfully, it's a pod, Bob, so you don't have to worry about anybody seeing your hair.
Okay? Good. Very good.
Out. But guys, thanks so much for joining me. First of all, it's so great to see your faces and hear your voices. What have you been up to in this quarantine?
Well,
Well, yeah, we'll start off with the Indian Wells cancellation. Mm-hmm. And then Nadia had a baby shower here in Camarillo. So we came up north 3 hours to Camarillo. And then Michelle got sick on that night. So she went into the Hampton Inn for a week of quarantine. God. And then I, on the heels of that, I got sick. So that was 2 weeks gone.
Wait, did you get COVID or just not well?
No, she got tested. She it took 6 weeks to get the test results back, but she was negative. She still thinks she got it because it was like right in line with the symptoms. And then I got a bad stomach flu. And then the pandemic was in full swing. So we got an Airbnb because we didn't want to travel. We didn't want to go back to Miami. It's Airbnb for about 7 weeks. Toughing it out, but it's nice. It's on a lot of land. Kids are running around, swimming, doing the thing. And then Mike with Nadia, they started getting close with the baby, and you know, right. And then bang, baby popped
8 days ago. So
yeah.
I got
so tell me how life's been with now being a father. Finally, you're so over people saying, when are you going to
I know. It's awesome. I'm a little low on sleep, but this little baby Jake is so cute. He's a little angel. Anything he does, I'm just, whoa. You know, he's pooped his diaper, but I was like excited, you know. But it was cool. Nadia did it all natural. We didn't go to the hospital. It her water broke at 1:30 a.m. So we went over to a birthing center, and she was a champ. Just bit a piece of wood and just took the pain like a, you know, like an all-star. But, yeah, I mean, it's been awesome. Been taking the baby over to Bob's house, had a little barbecue, my parents. So the baby's getting out and about, but awesome. Unreal. Oh,
that's so great. Yeah, I was really happy because you kind of kept on the down low a little bit because you weren't out there, you weren't playing. So, you know, press aren't all over you about a million questions. So it was nice when I saw your event the other day on Insta Live when you were raising money. Well done on that, by the way. You want to tell us a little bit about your foundation and what you were doing the other day?
Yeah, we started the Brian Bros Foundation a little over 10 years ago. You know, Agassi set a good example for us, doing all his work with the school in Vegas, and he was our idol. He joined us for our first event in 08 to help launch our foundation. It was super nice, flew over, and we raised a bunch of money. We've been doing a yearly event, raising money for Team Brian program, which is also in Vegas. It's a bunch of kids. I come from some tough situations, and through tennis and mentoring and, you know, through schooling, they're starting to get scholarships. They're 133 full scholarships to universities. And it's just a really special program. The best one I've ever seen. You know, I think 95% of these kids that come through, you know, go on to have amazing scholarships and they become leaders in the community. So on our birthday, we want to just take that time to help raise money. So we had our buddies on. You know, I should have got you, Stubbsy.
Yeah.
I saw Stubbsy. She said, keep the hat on. Okay. I saw your comment.
I was watching. I did like Mike's hat, and you were being trying to be big brother, although you're a little brother because you're 2 minutes later than Mike. So him to take the hat off, and I told him.
We just found out Bob's older. We just found that out.
Yeah, that was weird.
No, you did not.
Before we got married, Nadia and I here in December, I had to get a birth certificate. And it said second twin on my birth certificate. Yeah. So then I had to get $25 and get Bob's, and it said first twin. So my parents mixed it up. And so for 42 years, we've thought the other way.
Yeah, that was wild.
Oh my God.
That would have changed everything. That was weird. It was weird. You know, I was always the bigger and stronger,
2 minutes bigger,
faster. So I didn't think it was right that I was the younger twin.
But yeah, because you ate everything, and then you were like, "Out of my way, bro."
Yeah, no, it was a weird thing. Yeah, but with that, the birthday, we had 20 people come on during 2 hours. I think it was 25 actually. Mm-hmm. So everyone got 4 minutes on Insta Live. So it was like one question, and then cut them off and move on to the next. I didn't think we'd be able to pull it off just because of all the in and outs and, you know, busy schedule and, you know, but everyone got in there somehow. I skipped Query. I forgot Query. I had a list on the wall.
He won't care.
Query and Anderson, I just kind of, they were there, ready to go, but I just skipped them.
They'll never forget
it. No big deal.
It's funny. I had Andy Roddick on the pod last week, actually. And one of the things he said was how great the tennis community is about supporting a lot of foundations and a lot of charity work. And you guys are indicative of that. So for 10 years, you've been doing that. So well done. It's funny that you bring up who came out of the womb first and who didn't. And now that that has all been messed up. It was kind of one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about. I'm going to get into that a little bit later, but I obviously know how you got into tennis. Your mom was a great player. Your dad coached tennis a little bit and he was like instrumental in everything. But was it always like a love for you guys early on, or were you very interested in it only, or was it other sports as well?
We just grew up running around in a swimming pool on the court, building forts, and all of our friends were there. So it was just our way of life. And my dad knew how to motivate us by taking us to pro matches, and he just kind of surrounded us in this tennis atmosphere, really fun loving. And we always played games and it was exciting. So, I mean, we played basketball and other sports, but it's just, we always wanted to be like our idols, because we went to Indian Wells when we were 8 years old, saw Agassi. We're like, oh my God, this guy, we want to be like this guy. We're wearing his clothes and had his posters on our wall. So it was, I don't know, my dad, he wrote a book on parenting. He has got these like side door motivational philosophies. Yeah. We didn't really know what was hitting us, but he was always, just inspiring us through, we saw it with our eyes first, and then we developed that love and that passion. And then we just loved playing together, and we were just pushing each other to get better. And we played our first tournament at age 6 and played one every weekend, but you know, we just loved it. We'd go play the tournament, then we'd go like get pizza, and then we'd play miniature golf and did it with our buddies.
No, they were very smart about hooking us early. Like, we fell in love out of the gates. My mom and dad would take us down to the Great Western Forum. We would see Agassi, you know, play Courier. They took us down to the LA tournament at UCLA. We were watching the matches. We were playing hide and go seek around the courts. We were ball kids for the tournament. We'd go down to Indian Wells every year. So we were just kind of, we want to play tennis on Monday. And they would say, no, guys, not today. We'll play tomorrow. So we were chomping at the bit. They're holding us back. And when they let us go, we were going full steam ahead. We knew everything about every pro. We knew their middle names. We had the rankings memorized from 0 to 200. And then Agassi was, our God. He wasn't just a player. It was kind of like a religious.
You were like, get this guy out of here.
Yeah, we would always debate that, Pete and Andre, that was like Rafa and Fed, today. That was the big conversation. Who's better? And, Pete had all those number ones. He had the slam. So we were fighting the uphill battle with the kids at the club. But, Agassi, there was something about watching him, the way he did it, He had a little bit of curios in him earlier in his career. He would tank a couple matches, but he had that flair and he was just fun to watch. And then, late in his career, he was wearing the all white, tightened it up, and he was very professional. So he had a huge transformation from the long hair guy to the shaved head. But he was always our guy. He was our guy.
And we had the same birthday.
Yeah. And then when my first match on the tour. Right?
You do.
Same birthday.
How do I not remember? I tweeted that the three greatest American tennis players, and I put the three of you in there.
Yeah, he just turned 50. We're 42.
Yep. He actually sent us a really nice message on our 40th, blew us away. But one of my first matches on the tour, I got a wild card at the LA tournament. I played him in singles. I drew him first round. I was shaking in my boots. Then Mike qualified for the Open. I think it was back in 2000 or 2001.
2001.
And he drew Agassi night match Arthur Ashe Stadium.
No.
Yes. Yeah. It was unbelievable. Mike was, staying with them. It was like, four on the first.
I was hanging early, but he just kept me on this yo-yo.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow, he hits hard. He should hit harder than this, but he just wanted to get me tired. He was throwing me side to side, and then he took my legs out. And then the last two sets were like
1-0, like in 30 minutes. He rope-a-doped Mike. He was very smart. He would have the chance for the winner, and he would take the foot off the pedal and let Mike back in the point.
It was a bad matchup. I was trying to serve and volley. He's roping returns and just passing me. I served like under 50% because my legs were gone. And then, I've never watched that match because I was like kind of embarrassed.
Mike, just watch the first set. You're all good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. You look good early.
I was digging.
Yeah, really you, Hey, we've all got those stories, Mike. I almost took a first set off of Lindsay Davenport at the Australian.
Yeah, yeah. I watched you play singles. You were money.
I got hooked. I got a bad call. You can ask her.
What was your best Wimby?
Second round. I got really tough draws, I will say.
Bad draws.
I got tested. Like, I got really good draws. Lauren McNeil. I qualified like every time, but I couldn't get past like these really good players on grass anyway.
How good did it feel to get out of Roehampton though? That's like the best feeling in the world is when Wimby, because the qualies are Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
Yeah.
So you qualify on Wednesday and then you get those beautiful 4 days to go over the main site with your credential, bask in the glory.
Yeah.
I qualified once.
Yeah, the Roehampton like win, like that last win, and knowing that you've got it, you can leave there and go to Wimbledon. My first year I qualified and I was like this greatest day of my life. It literally is like one of my top of all my slams and that my greatest.
Yeah, that's my mom's grace moment of her career is when she qualified. Because Roehampton's just brilliant. As you know, it's
a long road.
It's a lowly, you know, sad little place of a battlefield. There's, you know, 50 courts in a row, balls are going on your court. There's very, very few people watching and it's windy. It's and then you go from there into Disneyland. Disneyland. You go through the big golden gates of Wimbledon and you've gone from being the scumbag to being like part of the show.
To being in the members locker room now.
The members locker. Yeah. I got to the last round 4 times. I only qualified once, but it was my best.
I don't know how that's possible with your serve running into the net. How do you not qualify every time anyway?
One year I got to the quarters of Queens, but I drew Prinisil, who had just won Hall A in the last round qualies. He beat Rafter in the finals. So we were both pretty hot. And I was up 2 sets to love. It was the year that all the Spanish guys boycotted.
Last round.
So he was already in the tournament. He was already in. He knew it. He was lucky loser.
Yeah.
So he's playing for nothing. He's holding his shoulder, holding his knee. I'm up 2 sets to love. He leaves the court for like 20 minutes. I think he's going to get defaulted.
He walks 300 yards, you know, the road to the bathroom in Roehampton.
Yeah. It's so far away.
And he walks so slow. I remember it was 30 minutes.
Yeah. Until he came back. I thought, okay, this guy is going to default. Like, I was so stoked. I'm in Wimbledon. And he came back.
The biggest mistake, Bob.
He just started lighting me up. And I lost in 5. It was a killer. And I was 1 out. I didn't get in the tournament. You know, like 9 Spanish guys pulled out and I was the next lucky loser. And I was just, that hurt.
That hurt me.
Yeah. Yeah. Because Mike would have enjoyed half of my prize money at that time.
Exactly. Yeah. So guys, why was it so important? Like your parents, were they really wanting you to go to Stanford, go to college? Or were you just like, that was always going to be your path?
I think they had a master plan, like in my dad's yearbook. In high school, we looked at it the other day and it says, my sons are going to be champion tennis players. And so I think he had this vision that, you know, he actually took us to the NCAAs in 1990 and we watched Stanford and Dick Gould and all the legendary Stanford, like Palmer, Stark and all these guys. So we watched that and we always wanted to, we actually went to Sizzler. We followed the team, like we kind of like tailed them and we followed them to Sizzler. And, you know, they went up to the buffet bar and we went behind, you know, and we're like, oh my God, these guys are just legends.
We stalked
them.
They're creeps.
But, you know, on our refrigerator, we'd write down our goals and we were like, you know, we went Stanford and USC. It was Stanford or USC. But literally, I think USC was the front runner for a lot of years because of Dick Leach and my dad and Dick Leach were so tight. And Ricky Leach was one of our idols in doubles. So at the last moment we decided to go up north. We wanted to go on the farm because we wanted to be with Paul Goldstein, and these like US juniors.
Well, Dick Leach held 2 scholarships for us for years. Mm-hmm. So we were always, you know, going to USC. We're going to be close to home. You know, our parents would come down and stay, keep an eye on us and keep working with us.
And the recruiting trip was insane.
The recruiting trip was amazing. You know, we hung out with Keyshawn Johnson and the band played for us. We ran on the field. You know, they played for us at the Coliseum on this podium and we were holding the 2 fingers in the air.
And then you just dumped.
They actually beat Stanford in the game on a last second touchdown. I think Keyshawn scored and he like pointed at us, you know, so we were just on adrenaline and signing day was the next morning.
Yeah.
So we went home And we're like, okay, SC's in there. And then we kind of, we typed all the pluses and minuses from both schools. And I think Stanford had one more plus. And
definitely wasn't the girls.
Yeah, definitely. But I think it was Paul Goldstein that pulled us in there because we actually idolized him. He was the best junior player to ever play.
Yeah.
And we just wanted to be with that guy. He was just a winner. Yep. And Dick Gould called us. He's like, if you guys are on the fence, I'm driving down. It's a 6-hour drive. I'm driving down. But we decided Stanford. And then my dad had to make the call. And it's the only time I've ever seen him cry. He picked up the phone to Dick Leach. And he's, the boys are going up north. And then he just started sobbing. Because our families were so tight. And that kind of broke it off.
Yeah, for a couple of years, it was a little bit tense with the Leaches. I mean, we're all good now. We love them. But, I mean, at the end of the day, Stanford had all Americans. They were all our national teamers, all our buddies. You know, and then USC, we actually, on a recruiting trip, we didn't meet one of the players. It was weird. It was all foreign players.
We didn't go to tennis courts.
We didn't go to the courts. You know, they only had 5 courts, which at the time was pretty amazing. You know, nice stadium, but not enough courts to actually play a full match. So they'd always play the 5, and then the first guy off would finish, and the next match would come on.
I remember Dick Gould drove us around. He drove us up to like the hills of Stanford, and like he's like, just take a breath of that fresh air.
Yeah, the redwoods.
It's not going to smell like that down in LA.
That's a good decision. Well, it was a good decision. Obviously, you guys were amazing at Stanford, particularly Bob. You got the triple crown, I think, singles, doubles, team title. That was amazing. When you left Stanford, how overwhelming was it to turn pro? And, you know, you were both still playing singles, obviously, but what was the moment? Because I remember the moment when I decided, okay, enough with the singles. Like, I was pretty old. I was like 29 when I decided to quit playing singles.
Yeah.
Like, well, what was it for you that was like, all right, other than rankings, was there a moment where you're like, all right, I think we should put all of our efforts into doing the doubles?
Yeah, I mean, look, when we went to Stanford, we needed Stanford. I mean, we always dreamt of going to college. We were 125 pounds when we entered Stanford. And we were 100.
Not that much bigger than that now.
No, you're the same. Skinny. We were 165 pounds when we turned pro in 98. That was after our sophomore year. When we won the NCAA team title, and then we won the doubles and the singles, we still never thought about turning pro. We were having the time of our life. We both had girlfriends. It was just awesome. You know, it was just a social awakening. You know, we had always been kind of in this bubble. We were loving it. We were in part of the fraternity, like Mike said. And, you know, Dick Gould actually called us into his office. We went back to take finals and we're on campus and we get a call from Gould. We come in and in the office is Gould and my parents. And Gould's like, guys, it's time to go, you know.
Wow.
You've done it all. We're like, really? Like, you know, you're a coach, you're trying to win next year too, but he's telling us to go. So we're like, all right, let's go. And they're like, yeah, there's some money there, you know, for some, you know, guaranteed contracts. And, you know, suddenly we're out there in Waco, Texas, you know, playing in the futures and challengers. And it wasn't glamorous.
Did you ever think for a period of time there that it was a mistake? Was there ever a time you doubted?
No, I mean, once we, you know, wrapped our mind around it, we just went, you know, and our goals shifted, you know, we shifted to, you know, trying to win that tournament out in Texas, Louisiana. And we actually had success right out of the gates, you know. I think I won my first 4 futures and singles. We started dominating doubles. We had like this 45 match win streak coming out of college in doubles, and we continued it. We took it to about 70 matches. I think we won 4 futures, 2 challengers, and it took us all the way to the semis of Washington, D.C. Before we lost our first match. So we did get a little boost. I had some wild cards in singles. We had wild cards in doubles. We got to play the Open. You know, things were going well, but you know, doubles and singles it was tough to split the schedule up. You know, we are in the big time in doubles, you know, but we're in Louisiana playing singles.
I get
and,
it.
Yeah, you did it. You saw, but it was tough to do both. So after a frustrating couple of years, we decided, hey, we want to play Davis Cup. We want to play the Olympics. We want to do this together. We have more fun playing doubles. We're better at it and we enjoy it more. And so we decided in the December of 2000 to put all of our eggs in that basket. And I think we were only 22 years old at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. You were still playing.
a couple qualities.
To make that full decision.
Yeah, I was like, I was a 116 in the world in singles, and you know, knocking on the door to be in the main draw of slams. But we actually just decided to pull the ripcord and just start going.
It was my decision.
Yeah, no, it was actually Mike was the one that pushed it.
He's like, enough with this bullshit qualifying. No,
I was actually struggling with like hip injuries and stuff. So I was playing singles, but I wasn't recovering well. My body was feeling a little bit crappy. And, you know, I was like, do you want to go to Indian Wells or you want to go to like China and play a future? Yeah. You know, like, so it's like two different tours. We wanted to be in the show and we were just super excited to move up the rankings in doubles. And we just loved playing together. We loved winning together, losing, whatever. We just loved doing it together. So I kind of said, Bob, I know you have singles dreams. You're knocking on the door, top 100. I mean, he was knocking on the door. You're one match away from like the main draw Aussie Open.
Yeah.
I think the difference was when Mike actually stopped traveling with me in the fall of 2000, I went over to Knoxville to play a challenger. I needed to make a semi to get straight in the Aussie Open. I end up losing first round and I spend Thanksgiving in a Motel 6, and I call a taxi and I go have Thanksgiving with the taxi driver in a Waffle House. And I'm sitting there talking to the Mike's enjoying it. He was in Santa Maria at my grandparents' house. You know, they're playing football and just eating turkey. And I'm in Waffle House eating with the taxi driver. And when I came home, I was
Who invited who in for the dinner?
Well, I invited him. I just said, dude, like, I'm going crazy. You know, there was no like, I was playing Snake on my Nokia, you know, on my Nokia phone. there wasn't much else to do, you know, reading the newspaper. And anyway, I came home and Mike's like, hey, man, you want to play doubles? I'm like, yeah, let's go. You know, screw this. It wasn't fun. So, so we wanted to do it together. And literally, if I didn't have Mike out there for this many years, we'd probably retired at 32 years old. And that's always the age we thought we were going to retire at. I don't know how long you thought you're going to play, Stubbsy. I mean, you play until you're 40.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I always thought, okay, 32's, that's a good age, like 32.
Yeah.
And then bang, 32, we're at the London Olympics and there's no end in sight. And you probably thought same thing.
Yeah.
It's 1 year stacks on the other. And now here we are 42 and you know,
It goes quickly, especially when you're successful like you guys.
This episode of the Racket Magazine podcast is brought to you by Sergio Tacchini, revitalizing and disrupting the status quo since 1966. Follow them on Instagram at @SergioTacchini_official and go to SergioTacchini.com for more. Enter the promo code RACKETMAG at checkout and you'll get 30% off your order.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Was there ever a time where you considered not playing together? Was there ever a time where you're like, oh, why don't we at least have a little bit of time away from each other? Or was that never an option for you?
I don't think it ever entered our minds. I mean, we've just been a package deal since day one. Played every match together in the juniors. It didn't even cross our mind. I know when teams lose and they have a bad patch, they're always thinking, oh, the grass is greener. You know, maybe I can find a better returner or like a quicker guy.
Bob, that was a slap right there.
Fine.
This is well known. This is my guy, and you know, we only did it a few times. Like, Bob had a baby, so I went to go play with Marty Fish at Davis Cup, and that's just weird. You know that. You know it's.
Yeah.
But I mean, look, Stubbsy, you had success with a lot of different partners, but I'm sure there were times where you guys had three bad losses in a row, and you're probably like, wait, you know, maybe I should go back to this partner, or maybe I should move on. I don't know how
the biggest mistake.
Some players are super loyal and they don't even think about that. But as twins, we're like that. It never enters your mind.
It's better knowing that there's no option. You're just going to stick it out. So you're always building week in and week out. Your experience is getting better. Our chemistry is always growing. And, you know, you're traveling with your best friend. I mean, this guy, you know, I know him better than he knows himself. And so I felt like over time, we're just building. And it took us until 25, you know, to win our first slam.
Talk me through that, guys. Talk me through that. Was my next question about that.
Yeah. I mean, we just every year, so we won our first title. It took us 2 years to win our first title. We had a couple good wins. We beat the Woodies, but you know, everyone's like, when are they going to win their first title? You know? And we finally did it in Memphis, and then we won a few more. And then the next year we won our first Masters Series. And then the next year was the French Open, and we had lost a couple heartbreakers at Indian Wells. We're up 6-2, 5-2, Bob serving in the finals of Indian Wells, our home tournament.
What?
That was our dream.
Maybe 5-3. I think it was one. It was one break.
And then up 4 on the third, and it just slipped. You know, we're playing Kafelnikov and Ferrer. They just made us play. We got tight. You know, we didn't.
No, but it was crazy. It was hot, and we're holding easy, and it was quick doubles. And then suddenly the sun got behind those mountains.
Oh, yeah.
And our serves just weren't popping. Nothing was happening. And those guys, you know, made every return at our feet, and it got ugly. And that was one of those matches where we had to read it in the newspaper to believe it really happened.
And then the same thing happened in Miami against Leander. And was it Rickle?
Rickle. Semis.
Same thing, semis.
6-3, 5-2.
We just learned a huge lesson that, like, you never can take your foot off the gas. And that's why you see us always bouncing around and moving our feet.
Yeah.
Because then we went into the French Open that year. And we just said, we're playing every point. It doesn't matter if we're up 4-1. And so we just got super hot. Our energy was like crazy high. And we just drilled teams. We didn't lose a set. Our only set that went over 6-4 was in the finals. And we just put it together. We stayed at the Pierre Vacances. It was the junior hotel. Yeah. Because we got there.
Have you ever stayed there, Stubbsy?
No, I never stayed there, thank God.
We got there 10 days early because we lost in Hamburg and we just wanted to get there and prepare. We just hired Phil Farmer, who was kind of like a spark. He had good energy.
Yeah.
He'd piss in these little huddles before the match and we'd pray. He was like really religious and he had these game plans. He was like the first guy to like write down these note cards. And so we just went into every match like super fired up. We were like superstitious. We had the Chinese restaurant 21 days in a row. And
we're the only people in there. It was bad Chinese. And we'd walk in, we'd hand them the Dave Matthews CD, Crash. And they would just start playing it in the speakers because we were the only people in there.
But won your 41st title, were you like Dave Matthews?
41. That's still our favorite song.
But we had this fire under us because Patrick McEnroe said, if you want to play Davis Cup, you got to be number one in the world and win a slam. Because he didn't want to take the chance on putting us on the team and then one of the guys getting hurt. So he's like, you guys got to be an automatic. And it felt like we should have been the team for 2 years, but it was just breaking our heart every time you'd announce a team and we weren't on it. And so that was a huge dream. And so we're like, we got to win this French. We got to get to number one. And then we visualized it. We just wanted it so bad that it finally happened. And then that took a lot of pressure off. Then we started, you know, playing great.
Do you remember the night before the final? Do you remember having?
We didn't sleep for, I would say 4 or 5 days. Because, you know, Pierre Vacances, well, you don't know because you never stayed there. The bed rock hard. The floor is actually softer than the bed. So we moved our blankets down to the floor. Remember that?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's one of those things where the hallways are dark until you start walking and the lights click. Shining. They just kind of keep flickering down the hallway. And, you know, the breakfast is horrible. So we had our aunt was coming over making us these Mexican eggs in the morning. And then we were just going on adrenaline. Like Mike said, we'd get up one break. We'd be like fire in our eyes, you know, going 2 breaks. We got to get 2 breaks and then 3 breaks. this thing isn't over, but yeah, it was just a rabid.
We won the last 16 points of the match.
Yeah. So we were super nervous, but we didn't have a chance to get nervous because we won so many points in a row to finish. It was like a flurry, but we were actually nervous on the flight to Queens because we're like, we're Grand Slam champs. We can't crash now. So there was like turbulence, and that's the most scared I've ever been. We wanted to enjoy it a little more.
Like, you're just thinking about that Alanis Morissette song, you know, isn't that ironic?
Yeah. And then we had this, it was a big check, you know, we'd never seen money like that, you know, I probably got, but it's bigger now. It was like probably three.
It's funny. It's a lot bigger now. Yeah.
We said, if we win the French, we made a promise with Phil. We're going to go right when we get to London. We're going to go buy Cartier watches
at Harrods.
So we get to London and we go into Harrods and we're like, damn.
4 days in a row.
These things are expensive. Like, we're like, it wasn't that much money. You know, like, we didn't pull the trigger.
No, we kept looking at them.
You didn't buy them.
We were going to get them engraved and, you know, we had all these plans.
We're like, the next slam. Let's do the next slam.
It's like, we didn't have the money in our hand. It was just a digit.
Yeah, it was just a computer
wire. Well, I hope that eventually you bought one because you ended up winning 16 together.
So. I actually did a couple of years ago because I wanted to get my wife a watch and she's like, you can't get it for me unless you get yourself something. So I said,
you got the diamond encrusted one for her though. Yeah.
So guys, you know, you end up winning 16 Grand Slams, which is unbelievable, together. Obviously, Mikey went out and strayed and cheated on you and won two more with Jack. But
we'll
get to that in a bit. But obviously I played with Lisa, and Lisa was like a sister to me. Obviously we were very close together. So it was really hard. There were times where we wanted to kill each other, right?
Yeah.
It was shit done. Like, I can tell you one story where we won in San Diego and we told each other to fuck off at four. Yeah. I won in the third and we didn't say a word to each other and we won the match 7-6 in the third.
Yeah, we did.
Because we didn't say a word, but we knew each other so well.
Yeah.
What's some of the like fun stories of that? Man.
Well, it's a very delicate balance with us, especially just because we've seen so much of each other and we don't treat each other like normal partners. We're brothers. So if he tells me like, oh man, you got to start hitting your second serve, like that just burns, you know? I'm like, I don't want to hear that from him, man. Like, so it's better when there's no real leader and there's not a lot of talking. So a lot of times we say, okay, let's just.
But there's no leader with you guys.
We try not to have a leader because you don't want to.
If there is a leader, it really affects the team in a negative way. If I'm trying to coach Mike, then he's feeling insecure and that's gonna blow up in our face. Same thing with the opposite. It's better if we're both equals and we're both being quiet.
Yeah,
and we're both only saying positive things about
even
strategy, and
even too much positivity is bad because we're still talking too much. I'm like, great shot, and then I don't say it. And he's like, hey man, didn't you like that return? Like, so we do better when we're quiet. That's why we use like hand signals and we play quick. In Wimbledon 2006, we got in a brawl. We actually won the first round, but we were still like pissed that we won 10-8 in the fifth. We were dead. We're super hungry. We got in the car and then Macker starts going over. He starts analyzing the match and then we start pointing fingers, and Macker always has to come in between us and be like a mediator. But he was in the front seat. We're both in the back seat. And so we started going after each other. Bob took the first swing, gets me on the head. But then usually, you know, we like, he breaks us up, but no one could break us up.
We're in the back
seat. So I started swinging. Our car was rocking side to side. The driver's like looking back, what's going on back there? Macker's crying, hey, stop that. And it was a full-fledged just war. We're bloodied up. And then we apologize to the driver. We start walking up the stairs to our flat. And Bob gets me with one last hit to the back of the head. And I just kind of take it. I take 10 seconds. And then I mule kick him off the stairs.
That was a cheap shot.
And he flies back off the stairs. And I run up to the bathroom because I know he's coming at me. He's going to kill me. Like, he's got a racket. And then he's trying to beat down the door like here comes Johnny, like The Shining.
If I had a gun, I would have shot you.
But then the funny thing is, like, well, he broke my guitar. Like, I hear my guitar blowing up. It's splintered everywhere in the living room. And then the funny thing is, we're like having dinner, you know, a little bit later, and then we laugh about it. And so it's kind of a way to release. I know it's not good, but it's a kind of a way to release steam. And that's what we always do daily. You know, we get in these little tiny ones, but that was a huge one. Then we would go on to win Wimbledon, you know?
That's the thing. We're so intense. We hate to lose. We don't take practices off. Like, we can't separate practice from matches. Losing a practice set to us is like a warning sign that we're going to lose in the tournament. Mm-hmm. So we're just as intense in practice. We don't drink water. We're nuts. We don't like to miss shots, you know.
Well, I think, guys, that's like an important thing to teach people, is because I think I've always said, I say this to people I coach or just like random people or, you know, people that ask me for advice. I said, you play how you practice.
Yeah, it's true.
If you practice a little bit lethargically, or, you know, kind of like Roger does, right? Roger's like super relaxed, but that's how he plays, right? Rafa, yeah, super intense. Like, there's not a shot that isn't 100% every time.
Yeah.
That's how you guys play. You're like super intense. You're in people's faces. You're like not giving anyone a reprieve. So you can't possibly practice relaxed and then expect to be like that.
Yeah, and that's our, that's why I think, like Mike said, we do need those releases of steam. And, you know, we've gotten physical many times, after matches, during matches. but it does kind of release.
Remember one in one match? One time Lisa Raymond took a second serve, semifinals of the French Open. Ball was a fault. Have I told you this story?
Did she hit you on purpose?
In a drunken stupor in World Team Tennis when we were playing. No, she takes the second serve. The serve is a fault. She rails it at me, hits me in the ass, looks at me. I turn around. I'm like, what the fuck? And she looks at me. No big deal.
Totally
meant to tag me. I mean, there's so many stories like that. But what about on the court?
Yeah. Bob's got me at the few serves to the back of the head.
Well, I actually knocked him out in a match.
No one knows about this because it was on a side court, and luckily there was no cameras. But it was first round of the Aussie Open like 2 or 3 years ago.
I think Federer was losing on Rod Laver. So all the press, all the eyes were on that match. And we're on a backcourt. And
we're playing a Japanese guy that's 18 years old. You know, we have preconceived notions. We want to beat this team like 1-1.
Yeah.
You know, so we're playing, I think it was Fuksovich. And
we didn't know at the time. He's actually
like Yamasaki or, you know.
No, Nishioka.
Yeah.
He's good too, but we didn't know him.
But they were staying on the baseline. You know, it was, you know, we're like looking at it like, okay, we're in the second round here. And we're down a break in the first. And we start sniping. That's what we call it when we start making these comments. We call it sniping. And I know all Bob's insecurities. He knows mine. So he hits me where, it, you know, it hurts. You know, he tells me, oh, man, your serve, there's nothing on your serve today. You're like, nice athletic ability. You know, and then we get in this point where we have overheads and we don't put them away and we lose the point to hit a winner. And I give Bob like a little bit of a tap to the back of the head, you know, just like, hey, man, shut up.
He slapped me and said, like, you know, like the McFly. Hey, McFly. Yeah. But I had told him in the months leading up to that, if he ever did it again, I would knock him out. I mean, he did to me like a lot of times during the indoor season. I told him, I'll knock you out next time you do it. And we actually got in a brawl in the Vienna airport over the same thing. And then, what do you know? He slaps me on the back of the head during the match. And just instinctively, I turn around with a fist. And
he does like a windmill, like all the way around. So he got lucky to hit me where he hit me. But he did a full, like, no look with the arm. And he connected right to the occipital ridge. And I woke up on the ground. And I didn't know where I was. And I called the trainers out. They're giving me smelling salts.
I actually thought I broke my wrist.
Yeah.
I thought I broke my wrist.
His wrist was totally black.
What? How did this happen? He goes, he fucking hit me.
No. The mic's laying on the ground and he opens his eyes. He's like, congrats. You just made F in Sports Center.
Yeah. In Sports Center. Because it was still a big crowd. I'm like, someone had to get that. And actually.
But he dropped so quick that the crowd thought he was faking it.
Everyone's laughing.
They're all laughing and no one knew what to say. But our coaches, you know, they knew our fight in Vienna. They're like, oh my God, he's out.
What happened?
So then Mike starts getting smelling salts on the sidelines. Anyway, it was like one of those deals. We were both so scared. I was actually scared about, you know, the video going viral.
There was one guy that had it and it was a player and I had him delete it because he had it slow mode. He had this like.
Who was it?
It was Dusan. He had
He had music. He had Mike dropping like a little sack of potatoes and getting back up and then dropping. He had it on like this rap video. It was an amazing.
But we come back. We win the match.
I can't believe that you didn't save that for you guys.
I know. We were just so serious. So we go into press and we're like, oh, here we go. No one asked the question, like, what happened there? It's like, how was the match? You know, okay, thanks, guys.
No one saw it, you know.
Oh, my God. It's
Port 16. So, yeah,
luckily. Clean image of the Bryan brothers.
Dodged a bullet.
Intact.
But, yeah, I had a full-on concussion. I couldn't read for, like, a month. You couldn't taste. Bright light was hitting me. I had all the concussion protocols. You know, like, it was crazy.
I love that Bob's like, he couldn't eat.
The moral of the story is, if I tell you that I'm going to knock you out,
I'm going to get you next. I'm going to get him.
You know, he's the younger brother.
Yeah, I know.
He's the bigger one because he ate more and he stayed in the womb a little longer and took a binge.
Yeah, Mike, actually, you spent an extra week in the hospital because you're just a little.
I was jaundiced.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Mike, is that what meditation does for you? It helps you deal with your brother? Have you gotten him to meditate? Do you meditate, Bob?
With your concussion?
Yeah. I like Bob's never meditated a day in his life.
That's not true. Really? I don't know. I mean, people call it different things. You know, I just sit there, close my eyes, and visualize.
So before a match, Bob will be on his phone, like, playing games. That's how he gets his mind off of, like, you know, the match coming. But I always find, like, a quiet room, like a quiet, like, place in the locker room. Close my eyes, put a towel over my face, and, like, do some breathing. And, you know, I like it.
You know, we both visualize. I mean, I'm sure you do the same thing. You know, night before, you try to see the match, see the opponents, see what you're going to do. Just kind of, I don't know, absorb the environment a little bit with your eyes closed before you actually get out there, so there's no surprises.
Is there one moment on, like, court where you actually with each other, where you said something to each other, where you were like, "Oh man, I really got to pull him out of this," you know?
Well. Yeah, there's a lot of times where, you know, someone's going down a rabbit hole. A lot of times it will be if I lose serve, like first game of the match, that's a tough one. Or if Mike, you know, has a few break points in a row and doesn't get it. Those are times that, you know, he probably feels like he's a, you know, 10 for 10. And then, you know, same thing when starting a match. You know, I don't like to get broken out of the gates. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm trying to set the tone. So that's when the other brother has to step in and you know, just kind of take the pressure off it, to put a positive spin on it. Like, no big deal. We'll get him back here. You know, a lot of times we'll just kind of hum a song or, you know, sometimes Mike, remember you were doing a smiley face on your racket. He was actually writing a smiley face on his grip just to try to stay positive. Like, and often you just try to fake it. So that's you. A lot of times.
Hey, I get it. Fake it till you make it. My favorite saying on the tennis court.
There's been many times where, like, one of us will be, like, extremely hurt, but we'll just fake it with positive energy and just be an actors out there. And
Mike, what did you learn, like, when you didn't have Bob out there, when you did play, when Bob had his surgery to his hip, and how difficult was that for you? And like, what did you learn, like, personally with you on the tennis court? I mean, you had an amazing run with Jack. I mean, it was incredible that you got a partner like Jack that's obviously a Wimbledon champion himself. I don't want to bring that one up. But, you know, a good friend, what did you learn for you not having Bob on the court?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely missed him. And I didn't really want to play without him because I felt like we were in this thing together. And if he's going down, we'd done enough. You know, we were 40 years old. And I said, man, if you can't play another day, we'll just go out together. But he's like, I'm coming back. You know, I think I can beat this thing. You go out there and just stay sharp. I'll meet you at Wimbledon. I'll meet you in Atlanta. And so I was just like, okay, I guess I'll go play one with Jack. You know, kind of opposites attract. Our game styles were totally different. We were just kind of having fun. Like, he didn't really care, you know? So it brought this whole new perspective, like, we're out there. But once he got on the court, like, he's super competitive. But we didn't practice together. On our days off, he didn't even show up at the courts. I said, I don't really want to practice either. It was just a totally different from, like, super professional all the time with Bob. We do everything right, to, like, totally the opposite. And I don't know, the stars aligned, you know, we're down match points, and it just somehow worked out. Like, it felt like I had to kind of be
the leader, because I felt like he was riding this roller coaster of emotion. Like his mind is going, you know, in and out, and he's getting pissed. And I felt like, okay, this is maybe my time to step up and be like a leader, counsel, make him better. And I brought the best out in him, and it somehow worked out. You know, our styles of play were just perfect together. Mm-hmm. But I was always waiting for Bob. And yeah, no, Bob was super supportive. I mean, unbelievable. Like, he's always the first one to call after every match. And, you know, I think he kind of felt like, okay, one of the Bryans is winning. Like, he felt when Twins are so tight like this, it actually feels like you're winning. So
yeah, how did you feel about it, Bob? Was it?
Yeah, I mean, we had a tough couple of years leading up to that moment. And it was 16 and 17 were tough. Like, we were in a dark place. Mike had some personal stuff he was dealing with. Yeah. It wasn't very fun out there. Practices were getting bad. We were saying stuff to each other that was really hurtful. Our relationship was deteriorating. We came together at the beginning of 18 and wrote down goals for the first time in a few years. I wrote down all these personal, like, happiness goals. I just want to be happy and have fun again. Mike actually wrote down performance goals.
Yeah. So we had slipped off. I mean, we hadn't won a slam. We hadn't done much, but we wrote down like middle of the road goals. But then I wrote down, I'm just like, screw it up. Let's get back to number one. Let's win some slams.
Well, and he had just moved on from his long relationship, and he was actually, unbeknownst to me, he was friggin' happy. He was like, okay, I'm ready to go again. You know, like, he'd been carrying some stuff, and I was just like, dang, this has been not fun. Like, I just want to.
So it's probably the first time in your lives that you weren't literally simpatico. Like, Mike, you were getting divorced.
Yeah, I knew that I was in something bad, and I wasn't happy. I was carrying that on the court, and our energy is so connected that it would seep into him, and then he would also see that I wasn't happy, and my play was my health was getting bad because I was depressed. And then
he never once said a bad word about his ex-wife. I just saw like someone that I didn't know, and he was very depressed and low. And, you know, I just didn't know. I thought, okay, we're done. Like, this tour things is over. You know, we've lost whatever we had, we lost it. But then Mike writes these goals down. He's like, number one in the world, we're going to win two slams. We're going to da da da. I'm like, I was just looking, I was just kind of chuckling. Like, what, this guy's delusional.
I felt like a new man. I felt like I'd let him down for 2 years just because I was subpar.
Yeah.
I was playing like a 100 guy in the world, just had no energy, no enthusiasm for life. And then I had a fresh outlook, and I'm like, damn, I think we can do some stuff. We just changed the Babolat racket. We're like, yeah, we got some firepower.
I was just like, okay, prove it,
whatever,
prove
it to me, man. Let's see what you got. And then we had a great start to the year. We are all the way, you know,
We were number one in the race. We had won Miami, Monte Carlo, finals of Madrid. And then, yeah,
the sniper came for his hip.
My hip just exploded. We were actually one match away from getting back to number one individually, co-number one.
Wow.
And we had done that in those 3 months, which was just a crazy pace.
Yeah, it was
we were 25 years old again. And then I go down, and then Mike pulls out of Rome, comes back, hangs out with me, and he says, okay, actually tell me, go to the French and stay sharp. I'm going to try to be back for Wimbledon. He goes and plays with Query. They didn't really gel. He comes back. He's like, it's frustrating to play with new partners. Like, I'm just done until you come back. And then we thought about it. I'm like, okay, well, check with Sock. If he wants to go, then you should go over there. And he had, you know, I don't know, 100 grand slams in a row. He played like the record. I'm like, just keep the record alive. Just go over there. And then they freaking win it, which was a little bit too much to handle for me at the time.
Yeah, I would imagine.
I was like, wait, I wanted you to do well. And I think when he made the quarters, he got back to number one. But I couldn't process. I just remember I didn't watch one point of the finals. And I was just in the gym just doing push-ups. You know, I think I did like a rep of like 1,000 in a row. You know, my arms were just shredded.
Had you had your surgery?
No. I was just like, I'm just trying to figure out what's going on with my hip. I know it hurts really bad. I'm doing like shock treatment and like stem cell therapy, and like nothing's working. And then Mike's, he's coming back with the trophy. You know, I'm like,
and checks.
A little part of me is like, dude, that's a Brian. You know, that's an extension of what we were trying to accomplish. He did it. You know,
no one knows who's who anyway, you know, but part of me is like feeling sorry for myself. Like, that's supposed to be me, you know, not Jack.
Yeah.
You know, but Jack was super humble about it. He's like, dude, I'm just here, you know, until you get back. Mike could have kicked me when I was down. He could have just booted me. But I think it was good for Mike. It was like, it's like winning a mixed doubles.
Yeah.
You know, it shows you that you're actually great part of the team, that he is, you feel like I can really play, you know, and Mike winning that, like then I saw his confidence grow, you know, he was happy. He was playing well. Number one in the world. They go on, they win the Open, which was crazy. Well, then they win the World Tour Finals. It just kept going and going. And then, you know, then I finally just have the surgery and Mike's like, yeah, man, you know, I'll take you back. I'm like, cool. You know, and then
mid-December,
you know, I'd only been like 4 months since the surgery and I was moving pretty slow.
Yeah. We had some practices down in Miami,
tryouts.
And this guy was not moving well. And I'm like, damn, okay. The Aussie Open's coming up in a few weeks. I'm a little worried. You know,
I was a little worried.
Got like, that guy Jack Sock in the back.
On the flight down to Australia, you still couldn't really walk
straight. I was just hoping that the recovery would take place 3 weeks after that flight and I would actually be, you know, okay, and that people wouldn't know how bad I was, you know. But everything started healing. We faked it to the quarters of the Aussie.
I know.
And then we got kind of going. Yeah. But then we won Del Rey, we won Miami, and then our expectations grew.
Yeah. And then whenever we were like tied in a set, we're like, damn it, what do we do? Like, we wanted to be number one. We had these crazy goals, but I think they're just kind of outland. They're too far.
Yeah.
You know? So winning Miami was too early.
No, I mean, it's super emotional. You know, I was like crying, family's there. I never thought I was going to play tennis again. And, you know, but as being, winning, doing all the winning we've done, we were just like, okay, let's go for number one. You know,
yeah. How many titles?
Well, we won those two.
Oh, right.
We won those two in my backyard.
Yeah.
And I think we were number one or two in the race. And then we lost. We played Takao and Roger back to back in Madrid, first round in Madrid and Rome. We split that series and then we played them in the third round of the French. Ended up losing that.
But we're also up 9-4 on Cabal Ferrer in the Rome.
Yeah, 9-7 or 9-6.
Yeah. So we lost a couple really tight ones that kind of kept us on edge. And then at Wimbledon, we just kind of had the blowout fight on the court. You know, we made some really hurtful comments. That went south quick. We played a Mahut that was hurt. He's like in the locker room. He's like, hey, guys, I'm probably not going to play. I'm just going to
can't believe him.
Yeah. And then in the warm-up, he had a cane. And we go up a break and we're like, oh, when's he going to retire?
I love him, but he's a faker.
He would have retired had Mike held serve to win the first set. He would have retired. But he threw in a stinker.
Yeah, it's amazing how much your level drops when you know all you have to do is just play okay. And so it was just a mental.
Guys, you had to go back to 2003 when you're like, we got one break. We got to get two.
It's a mistake. No, I know. Well, it's funny. Like we had the expectations and we added this pressure to ourselves. At 41 years old, that was probably, it was unrealistic. We should have basically just been happy to be there and
been fun.
Hard, but I think winning so much early in that year, it was just like, we kind of changed our focus and tried to, it's a good lesson. Yeah.
I think when you get older, it is the one thing that I can tell you, you've got to find the fun. You've got to find because you've already accomplished everything. You don't need to prove anything, but what you need to prove is that you still love the sport. Guys, thanks. I mean, this has been awesome. I could talk to you for hours. I do have to ask you about what's going to happen with the retirement plans, because you were supposed to stop at the US Open. That was going to be the last hurrah, the last fight on court.
We felt like we had one more good year left in us, not getting any younger. And we thought, okay, we want to keep playing while we're healthy. And
so what are you going to do?
I don't know. I mean, look, we haven't hit many balls. Have you been hitting a lot of balls?
Hello? No, I don't need to.
So we went out there yesterday. We sprinkled in a couple hits, just trying to keep sharp. We'll see how we feel. I mean, now Mike's got the baby. I travel with the baby. It's challenging. So we'll see if he wants to do that.
It's hard to rev up the engines again when you shut it down for this long. You have to keep, you know, like we talked about, you have to keep, like the body at this age has to keep moving. You have to stretch, you have to roll, you have to do everything like a professional athlete does.
You do.
And it's just, if we really want to do that, we really want to play the Open and go out, but I don't think it's going to happen. Realistically, it's probably going to get moved. We're going to play team tennis. That got announced today. It's going to happen.
For the Vegas Rollers.
But yeah, we'll see where our head's at. You know,
yeah, no decisions yet, no decisions. Stubbsy, but we, you know, we want to play some of these tournaments that we love, Indian Wells, Miami, and Cincy and the Open. Those are the tournaments we love playing.
You might have to wait another year, fellas. I mean, listen, I'll take you for another year.
Stubbs, you got one more mixed doubles in you?
No, man, my hips are bad. I need the, you know, I got the hips, the knees. I mean, yeah. if you want to play, I mean, you did win the U.S. Open with Martina. She was 49. I just turned 49, so I got time.
Okay, there we go.
I got time. Well, now that you've been in quarantine, though, you know, away from all of this, is it given you?
We can do it.
Is it given you a sense of what you want to do? This is all over, though. I mean, you got kids now, and do you want to?
Yeah, no. I mean, we've definitely put a positive spin on the quarantine. Just kind of a reset. You know, spend time with the family. Gives you a little glimpse into retirement, what it's going to be like, daily routine. Yeah, and just hanging out at the house a lot. I've been cooking. Mike's full-time with the baby. We're thinking about, you know, what we want to do. It's hard, you know, to try to figure out what you, you know, because a lot of the stuff around the tennis world.
I mean, you spend a lot of time in California. You both have places in Florida. You spend a lot of time there as well. I know with your residence and everything. Mike, you're a lot more in Cali.
Yeah.
Bob, is it, has this given you a reason to maybe want to live closer to each other, especially now that you have cousins?
Yeah. I mean, I think we're the happiest when we're close to each other, and it feels a little weird to be all the way across the U.S. Cause I mean, we love doing stuff together and we want our kids to play together. I'm trying to get him to move out to California cause this is where it's at. I mean, look at this weather, just blue sky, palm trees, you got the mountains. And so he's got an Airbnb here. He's been here for a couple months. And I think you should
stay here.
You
should buy that Airbnb.
I'll stay here a little longer if you pay for my Airbnb.
No, I mean two extra Grand Slam wins.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
it's so funny how we split all our money until.
Recently. I'll write you a check.
Thank you.
I'll buy breakfast.
Yeah, yeah, but yeah, I think we got to get Bob out here. Let's convince him.
All right.
No, I love Cali. It's nice, but you know, Mitchie's family's all in Miami. It's gonna be a tough sell.
Yeah, and those Florida taxes.
Yeah. They're nice.
It's only 13% over here in California. It's not a big deal. It's a chunk.
Yeah. Guys, it's honest to God, like you're two of the best guys. I was there when you won your 100th, I think. You won that US Open as well. I mean, I've been around, I've seen you so much. I've played team tennis with you. I've shared the court only with Bob. Mike didn't play with me. Bob did. And we lost to Mike.
Did we beat Mike and Karina?
No, we lost, dude.
We lost to him?
You and Martina beat me.
Oh,
yeah.
Damn. Did we ever beat Mike?
No, you never beat
me. No, we played him once. I remember my funny.
Did I choke it?
Yeah, Bob let you down. I remember Stubbs, he was saying.
No, I have no idea. I didn't even know the score. But all Grand I remember.
Court night match, I remember.
Yeah. Here's my favorite. It was on Grandstand. My favorite thing about you, though, didn't involve you, Mike. Bob, Wimbledon. Do you remember this match? You played with Venus.
Yes.
I was playing with Todd Reed.
Perry.
Todd Perry. Thank you.
Yes.
Terrible. And I was playing the backhand side.
Yep. Oh, yeah. That lefty cutter was working that day, wasn't it?
And do you know, Mike, do you know how many returns I got in the court that day?
And
we were up a break in the first set, okay? My partner served for the first set. So we were playing pretty good.
2006. You've only been broken once on grass in 20 years. So probably you made one return?
Zero.
Yeah, Mike, that thing was cutting.
He was cutting. Here's the best part. On match point, this cocky son of a bitch looks at me, literally, at Wimbledon, and goes, "Where do you want it?"
No way.
Where do you want? I go, I don't know. And I go, here, forehand. I thought at least I might be able to bunt the forehand in the court. Nah, still hit it in the net.
Yeah, that was 06. Yeah, I was a 28-year-old.
Fresh arm still.
Dick. Yeah, just sliding me into the patrons on court three.
Yeah, you needed a ticket to be able to return that, sir.
I mean, how dumb. But I played you on the forehand side at the US Open, and I returned you pretty well. So I think that was a mistake. I never can play the backhand with you.
We had many battles there, Stubbsy. Sure, you got
it. We love you, Stubbsy.
I didn't play enough. Anyway, guys, I love you so much. Mike, I'm so congrats on the little Jake man. I can't wait to see them all together.
I'm gonna babysit little Jake one day.
I'm happy to. I'm a good babysitter. But yeah, I can't say enough words about how amazing you both are as parents, as brothers, as sons, as competitors. You're so respected on the tour with everybody. There's not a bad word that could be said about you because you played the game the right way. I hope to God we get to see you play a few more tournaments. I certainly want to see you maybe hold up one more slams. And if not, just work on that forehand, Bobby. You'll be fine.
Love you, Bobby.
I can't say enough about you. So thanks for joining me today. And take care of yourselves. I'll see you soon.
You're amazing. Bye. Bye.
And that's it for this episode of the Racket Magazine podcast. Thanks for listening. Our host is Renee Stubbs. Our co-host and producer is me, Caitlin Thompson. Music by internationally renowned DJ Stretch Armstrong. Thanks to Tim Rogerian and the team at Acast. Find us at racketmag.com/podcast and subscribe to us at any of your favorite podcatchers.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.